Dublin's Talking Sport.
Welcome to Dublin's Talking Sports podcast with me, Ken Doherty, and my good friend, Reggie Corrigan. Thanks for tuning in to catch up on the latest GAA, football, rugby, and all the crack. Enjoy the show, and don't forget, rate and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Another great show for you this week, the first of 2022, at our new time of 8:30 to 10:00 every Saturday. Ken caught up with the professional snooker player Cliff Thorburn, who, after 50 years, the grinder, is retiring from competitive snooker. So a great conversation with Ken and some good stories in there too. Declan Drake gets us up to date on all of the latest GAA news around the capital. And as always, Alan Cawley gives us some insight to the whole mess that's going on in United and also the signing of Coutinho for Villa. In rugby, Will Slattery and I had a good discussion about Munster and the state of affairs there, and previewed the Munster-Ulster game, which is on later tonight. I also caught up with Stephen O'Brien of UK Packers, talking about the Super Bowl and the likelihood of who's going to lift the Lombardi Trophy. Of course, his beloved Packers looking strong at the moment. So another great show this week, and you can download it, as always, wherever you get your podcasts.
Good morning, Reg. It's a little bit earlier than usual, but it's still a lovely morning.
It is. Well, it's still dark outside, but, here in Dublin, it's raining, but it's due to clear up. But, yeah, we have a nice early start now for all of our listeners catching up the early risers on our Saturday mornings from 8:30 to 10:00. So, it's looking forward to it. It's going to be good. But it was a disappointing day yesterday. I was watching it on the TV. So,
it was,
you've been playing great the whole way through it, and it just seemed like you couldn't quite click yesterday in the senior semi-final.
No, I got off to a bad start, and I lost the first couple of games. Came back all right.
Yeah.
And then lost a close one in the end to lose 4-2 to Peter Lyons. He went on to win it then, of course, in the final last night against David Lilly. Yeah, he beat Jimmy White, of course, in the semi-final. So, he played really well. He's been playing with, he did well in the UK Championship just before Christmas, had a really good run there, won a few matches and that, got the last 16, I think. So he's been around the block as long as I have, But it was a great event now, I must say. It's been really, really good here in Hull. It's a new city for snooker, and they've really embraced it very, very well, and really welcomed us well over the last couple of years. Not as many people as normal because of the COVID, even though a lot of tickets were sold. It's amazing. A lot of tickets were sold, but still people didn't want to come. They're still afraid of, mixing in the crowd and stuff like that. It's amazing. But it was still a great tournament over. And it was great to have it on Virgin Media as well.
Huge.
So a lot of the snooker fans could watch it live, which is fantastic.
And it was being watched. That's the thing about it. It wasn't a case of that it was on and no one was looking at it. People were talking about it. There was a great coverage of and a lot of viewership of it. And as I said, obviously, the interest with you being involved in it was huge as well. So it was great to see. I have to say, the pace was a bit slower maybe than what we're seeing at the World Championships.
just a little bit. I mean, Cliff Thorburn was here as well. He retired, which a great character as well over the years. He's been a pro almost for 50 years, he turned pro. And it was his last sort of bell as a player, even though he hasn't played on the professional circuit now for a while, but he's still playing the senior. But what a great character as well. He sort of bowed out as his last time. Dennis Taylor retired, of course, in May at the World Championships. But it's a great event, and it's great to have a few tournaments on the tour. There's only like 3 or 4 tournaments, but they're hoping to build on it, it was great to have Virgin Media on board to watch it, and hopefully they will continue to cover the tournament, like the World Championships and then the Irish Masters and Goffs as well, which would be great, down the road. So it was really, really good,
Absolutely. And you caught we're going to be listening a little bit later on to your interview. You caught up with Cliff Thorburn. I mean, as you said, 50 years. And I remember back in the 80s and 90s watching Cliff. And he was always the kind of gentleman. I remember my mother loved him.
He was. Yeah,
I think he was a real favourite amongst the mammies.
He was, He was like a Tom Selleck lookalike, wasn't he? He had the moustache and the slick back hair. He always looked immaculate. That lovely sort of gravelly voice, you know, the Canadian voice as well. And Irish, what a character. You know, he hustled his way around the whole of America, you know, North America, you know, playing in clubs and that. And he's got a fascinating story, you know. There was one story in the interview where he was trying to take money off this guy, $40 or $50 a frame, and the guy ended up going to his coat. He took all his money off. The guy ended up going to his coat to take a gun out to him, you know, and he walked towards him, and Cliff thought that was the end. He was going to shoot him, you know, and he asked the guy behind him, he says, "Hey, Joey," he says, "how much can you give me for this gun?" You know, so he wanted to sell the gun so he could still play, keep playing him. And Cliff had been playing him for like 36 hours trying to get all his money off him, you know. But yeah, he's a great character, fascinating story, and it was lovely to catch up with him. You know, it was quite emotional here for him this week.
Yeah,
you know?
Retiring. It must have been.
Walking out with the world championship, and it was really very emotional for him. But what a character, you know.
Yeah, well, I'm really looking forward to that interview. In the after 9 o'clock, we'll be playing.
But the funny thing was, I mean, he was called the Griner. He's one of the slowest players on the tour. And even when he talks, you know, I only asked him about 3 questions, you know. And the interview went on for about 20 minutes.
Very good. Okay. Well, as I said, looking forward to that one and hearing what Cliff has to say. I know you're also a huge tennis fan, and it's kind of gone a bit crazy, hasn't it?
Novak Djokovic
thing. I don't know. I can't believe
I have no sympathy for him. I don't know how you feel, but I have no sympathy for him whatsoever. You know, anybody who doesn't get the job in this day and age for whatever, you know, cannot be expected to go into a country that doesn't expect people accept people for without vaccinations. You know, so I don't know. He was trying to get in with a medical sort of exemption, but he doesn't really have any medical conditions. He's just like, he's opposed to the vaccine. He's quite vociferous about that. And I think he only has himself to blame. You know, I don't see any other reason why he should play in it and be exempt from while everybody else is getting vaccinated, you know?
Well, I saw an interesting comment made yesterday on Twitter. It was, if we respect the right for an athlete not to get vaccinated for the protection of their bodies, which we respect that right, then you have to respect the right of the organisers or of the host country not to accept that athlete. So, I mean, it kind of works
both
ways.
Yeah.
So if the rules are one thing, then that's the way it is. And yeah, look, I mean, it's a very, very divisive subject. I think most people are coming down on the side of you have to get the vaccines, but it is a divisive subject because people have their own views on it. But, you know, there's a lot of worry about it too, though, you know.
Yeah, I understand your choices. You know, you have your choices, but these are the rules of the countries and stuff like that. So they have their choice as well. So you cannot expect to be exempt by making your own choices, you know, when the countries have their own rules.
Like, I suppose,
you know,
the so big thing, though, Ken, is how did he get there in the first place? I mean, fair enough on the rules. If the rules are you have to be vaccinated again, that's grand. There's no problem. The rules are that. Fair enough. You know that going over. I suppose the big question is, how did it end up in this situation that he's over there? Like, how did he even get there with this so-called medical exemption? Were there changes made last minute? Is it a political thing, which a lot of people seem to feel that it is? It's more politics than reality. So, I mean, they're the real questions, I suppose. I just like the idea of him being in this concentration camp-style hotel thing that they talked about, you know, for him being stuck over there. That must be a real come-down for him.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, I think the state of Victoria sort of gave him a special exemption, but like the country didn't allow it, you know, so there was sort of a mix-up there. But he probably just jumped on a jet from Monaco, where he lives and resides, you know, and just flew straight there, like, you know, and was expecting to play. I think there is some sort of ruling on in the courts on Monday. But I doubt if it's going to be, because of the furore that it's caused now, I doubt if it's going to be overruled. I think he'd be sent home straight away.
I think it's ridiculous Monday. The amount of furore it's caused. I really do.
Yeah.
It's dominated news, and we're talking about it again this morning. He's a tennis player, for God's sake. You know, it's way out of proportion, the amount of news time that it's picking up. I think it's just odd.
I mean, I can understand if he doesn't want to get the vaccine. That's fair, because there are some snooker players who haven't had the vaccine, you know, and they won't. We have some tournaments now coming up, like we have a tournament in Germany and we have a tournament in Turkey, and they won't be allowed to play unless they get the vaccine. They won't be allowed travel to the countries unless they get the vaccine, you know. So that's fair enough, you know. I completely, if you don't want to get the vaccine, that's up to you. I understand that, but don't expect to play in a tournament where a country is not going to let you in unless you get vaccinated, you know, or double vaccinated.
You know that prior to
They cannot bend the rules for people when. Yeah. You know, the rest of us are abiding by the rules, and you know, and so many people, it's caused so much misery over the last couple of years, almost. You know, so don't expect to get any special exemptions. That's the way I feel.
Speaking of misery, what about United?
Oh, jeez! I tell you, a lot of those United players need different vaccines, you know, to get themselves going. That's for sure.
They need something, all right.
Oh my goodness! Oh, I tell you what a champ. I don't know the way out, to be honest. I mean, they're just not playing. They didn't play for Ollie at the end. They don't seem like they have the confidence in King Ralph, as he's been called. I don't know. I mean, the situation, you know, in the summertime, there could be a huge clear out of players, which I think will be a necessity, you know.
Okay, well, I'm joined now by the 1980 world champion, Cliff Thorburn from Canada, first overseas player to win the world championship, and he's hung up his cue this week after almost 50 years, Cliff, playing snooker. What a wonderful career.
Well, it's you know, it's been a lot of fun, and I met some wonderful people, you included.
Don't go that far.
I'm not expecting any money for that, of course. But, just turning pro when there were only two or three tournaments a year for me. Anyways, being an overseas player and getting to meet and play John Spencer, Reardon. There weren't any, you know, nobody wanted to tell you anything. I kept on asking questions, but there were no books, no videos kind of a thing. So I just sort of used my head a little bit. But it was very frustrating. The tables were, the pockets were tighter, the cloth was thicker, the balls were heavier, it was sticky and moist. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I've got some happy things to say about it, but I'll think of something.
We'll come to the happy bits in a while. Well, talk about happy bits. I mean, when you came over, you made an instant, like, sort of mark on the game. You got to the final at the Crucible in 1977. And then, of course, the famous victory against Alex Higgins in 1980.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's one thing that comes out of that. Well, that, you know, I'll leave Alex until the end, I guess. John Spencer, you see, he's the one that put my name forward to become a professional, and
which was at that time was a closed shop, wasn't it? So you had to be invited onto the tour.
Yeah, it was. I did, you know, but I ended up playing a 3-week match with him in various cities across Canada, but. I had no yardsticks. I probably only played in 5 tournaments in my life because I was just a gambler and just barred. I wasn't allowed to play. So anyways, I asked John if he thought that I was good enough to turn professional, and he said yes. And sure enough, put my name forward, and then I started to play. I really enjoyed the apprenticeship. Although it drove me
crazy
a few times, and I did, you know, and I didn't have a lot of money, and I was
but that's how you earned your stripes, wasn't it? That's how you earned your stripes, playing from city to city and playing for money and gambling and giving point start and stuff like that. Yeah,
yeah. But I became a very good road player. I could adjust to tables as well as anybody. I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, like with the amateur game in the old days. I mean, you'd have to play in different clubs, et cetera, and on different tables, learn, you know, and actually be better than the other players because you're playing them on their tables. But after a while, especially in Canada, like, you know, I play better than them on their own tables. They didn't know it.
What about what's your memories? Because, I mean, there's so many great stories and so many great achievements. Obviously, the standout one is the first one is the World Championship, and then, of course, the Maximum. We'll come to the Maximum in a minute. But the World Championship, winning that World Championship in 1980 against Alex Higgins, he turned out to be a great rival over the years, didn't he? And was he the guy who actually gave you the name The Grinder?
No, it wasn't. And what happened was, after the match was over, people, you know, said that I was grinding but never called stuck, The Grinder. Yeah. But. Yeah. David Vine said it. He said, he's a real grinder, isn't he?
and it stuck.
And then Alex said, he's a real good grinder. I believe you, me, or something like that. but it was okay. And then I found out that his wife had wheeled in
a big cake.
You know, congratulations, Alex Higgins, world champion, 1980 year of the Hurricane. I put my whole head in it, I think, at the end of it, because my wife and I were bothered by it. It's just something that people do without
thinking.
Did
that catch your goat up a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, I didn't see it, though.
Right, okay.
But I saw it after. I'm going, like this, because Bart, my wife, she's seeing the cake. You know, she's having a little chat with Lynn, she sees this cake being wheeled in at 16-0. And I just missed the brown, to make it 16-0. She just told me after her eyes were rolling. And then I made a 119 total clearance with no black ball, like it was safe.
Yeah.
And then in the next game, I think, the last frame, I ended up making two plants, with a 35 or 40 break, two plants where the balls, the first red was, 8 or 10 inches apart, and then another 3 inches on top of that to a pocket that was, a foot and a half away. So, I didn't miss that, and then I cleared up with a 70 break or something. I mean, nobody even talks about that. Unbelievable finish after missing the brown.
Of course.
When that happened, I went straight into a dressing room, and I screamed as loud as I could, until my face and went relief. Purple.
Just to
get away from everything.
Okay.
And as I was walking out, this was good for me too. As I was walking out, there's about four guys there with, Alex Higgins, Year of the Hurricane t-shirt. So I was really aware of that. And then, as I'm walking out, the one guy says, "Oh, you've got him, Alex. He's gone to the washroom to be sick." Well, that's the best thing he could have said, because I'll tell you, I just went in and I screamed at myself, and my face was just purple. But it was good for me to
And to get your name on the cup, the first overseas player outside of Britain and Ireland, your name on the cup was fantastic.
There's some dispute about that, and I want to say that because there was Horace Lindrum played Clark McConachy, and there's only two players, but they were worthy
of champions.
And New Zealand to Australia. Can't give up on that.
Tell us about. The iconic images of making the maximum, the first maximum ever at the Crucible against Terry Griffith, started with a fluke. But you went on to make one of the greatest breaks that the Crucible has ever seen. I mean, you must have been very, very proud of that moment.
I sure was. And I was, I fluked the ball. And I'll admit that I felt terrible for about half a second. I think that Terry was trying to get out of his chair, but it's funny I've had some dreams in my life that have come true, you know. Yeah. And about, I don't know if it was a month or something before that, you know, the 147, that I had a dream. And I was, well, I made a 147 at the World Championships. And the shot, that the thing that was very noticeable was that I had potted a red, and then, and you know, the balls were tight, and then I potted a half ball black bean, you know, high on it, and then the cue ball hits the black ball rail, jumps up in the air, and goes right kind of in like,
the middle
of the reds, and they spread like just like the you know the balls were there. So really, you know, I had done it, and and I have to throw in this other dream very quickly here.
Right.
That I played golf at my course in Walton on Thames.
Yeah.
I had a dream, like I told the guys on the tee, and Del Simmons was here, one of the, you know, the great guys that really helped the game.
Yeah, of course, one of the great
and,
promoters.
You know, sort of, you know, like we're going to tee off everything. I told him about the dream, and, you know, Jack Nicklaus, that I spent 4 or 5 hours with him. And then I go out and I shot 68, which is 200 par. The best round of my life. So I had a dream there. So the next time that I played with Adele Simmons, you said, any dreams last night?
What was that famous story about the guy that you took all his money off and then he went to the jacket and then pulled the gun on you?
Oh, yeah. So, I'm playing this fella, and we played for probably 36 hours, something like that. But, you know, because this is a 24-hour place. So anyways, we're playing 30, 40 bucks a game, something like that. And I won a lot of games in a row. Now, what happens is that, you know, like the guy wants to change the table, you know, and we changed tables probably about, I don't know, four or five times, you know, so what happened was that we ended up that, you know, like that long, we were that tired that we ended up, you know, leaving our coats by the first table, can't find it. So anyways, he's borrowing, you know, 30, 40 bucks off people like this. Yeah. And, you know, so, and then finally, like he's got no money left, that, you know, it's all over. And then he says, oh, just wait here. So anyways, he goes back, he finally finds his jacket, and he's walking towards me now, and he just, like, he pulled, you know, because I could see it, that he pulled out the gun, like a little pistol, but, you know, he's got a sort of, like, his hands on the trigger, you know, like, it's sort of down like this. He's not trying to hide it. It's just sort of down, like, for safety precautions. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and he's walking towards me, Ken, and I could just feel like all the blood just leaving my head, you know, like it was all in my big toe or something. It was, and I mean, my legs are gone now. I've just about gone completely. And he goes by me, and I'm going, you bugger, you know, you're going to shoot me in the back right? And then I hear, he says, hey, Joey, give me 50 bucks for my gun. Well,
The relief,
you know, but this is how tough I was, because now we started playing for 50 a game, and he beat me about 8 games in a row, because I'm gone completely, I wanted to get his last 50, but it took me, I don't know, 6-7 hours to get the 50, and it probably cost me 50,
It's time to turn our attention to football now. I'm delighted to be joined on the line, as always, by Alan Cawley. Good morning, Al. How are you?
Good morning, Reg. I'm good. Yourself?
Oh, very good. It's great to be back. Happy New Year to you. All went well over Christmas, I'm assuming.
Well, what's well, Reggie? I was very sick, to be honest with you. I was struck down with COVID, like so many others, but I actually was very sick with it as well. So I know a lot of people are saying it's fairly mild and people haven't suffered as much, but it certainly wasn't mild for me, Reggie, but I'm getting through it anyway, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, you're not the only one I've spoken to. I had it myself. We all got it in my house before Christmas. I missed the show before Christmas because of it, but Thankfully, most of us were okay, although I will agree with you, my wife did get it quite bad. And I've spoken to many people who have, so like, it's not this, you know, just nothing. That for some people it is, but for some it's not. So like, let's all respect it and respect people that do get it, because it's it knocks you out a bit. It does, there's no question about it. But hopefully now you'll recover and you have immunity, and we're going to be out of the other side of it.
Exactly, Reggie, exactly.
That's the most, that's what we hope for this year, and that's what we're hoping for 2022. Okay, there's been some interesting news in the signings front in the League of Ireland. Big news, I suppose, as Owen Doyle coming back to St. Pat's.
Yeah, probably the biggest story in a lot of big stories in the off-season so far, Reggie, but this is probably the biggest in my view, because obviously we spoke about before Damien Duff is going to be managing in the league. Jack Byrne has obviously come back, but this is huge news for St. Pat's, because Owen Doyle has had 10 years in England playing kind of championship, League 1, League 2 level, and scoring goals regularly at all those various leagues. So for St. Pat's to get him, when he's still kind of all in his prime, really, he's only early 30s on, he looks after himself, he's very fit and well, and I think he still had 18 months, 2 years left to run on his contract at Bolton, but did want to come home because he'd spent 10 years over there, and he has a relationship with Tim Clancy, so it's a huge coup for Tim Clancy, because I know Owen Doyle spoke before about if he was to come home, he'd love to play for Shamrock Rovers because they were his team. So for Owen Doyle to get him at St. or for Tim Clancy to get him at St. Pat's, it's a massive signing, not only for Pat's, but I think it's huge for the league as well, Reggie.
I think it is as well. And I haven't got a clue about the finances of football or what they're worth in the lower divisions in England. But if you've got an 18-month contract with Bolton, surely that's more financially rewarding than coming back here, or am I wrong in that?
Yeah, I wouldn't think so, but maybe in Owen's case it probably was, Reggie, because he was their main man and scored goals, and so he would be on a decent contract. But I think the wages in general at League 1, League 2 level aren't the best financially in terms of the fact that you have to sustain yourself for the rest of your career or anything like that. So I think what Pat's have offered him is probably very lucrative, or maybe, I'm not sure if it's along the same lines as what he was on over there, but it's certainly a longer term contract because he's after signing a 3-year deal. So it was probably a bit more security in that as well. But he was keen to come home. He had spent 10 years over there. His wife is from Dublin as well, and young kids. So he was keen to come home. So I think the fact that he had the relationship with, played together at Hayes years ago, they've always stayed in touch and been friendly. And the fact that Tim has just taken over at Pat's, I think the conversation was had, and I suppose they got a deal together with the owner, Gareth Keller, who has invested heavily in St. Pat's over the years. And coming off the back of the FA Cup, the FAI Cup win as well, I think it was big for St. Pat's because there was a bit of doom and gloom, surprisingly enough, after them winning the cup, because we all know what happened with Stevie O'Donnell, and I think some of the fans were afraid they might lose some of the players, but they've seemed to have held on to the majority of them for now. Obviously Robbie Benson, who we expected to go back, is on the up, has gone back, but they've held on to the majority of them at the moment, and I think the signing of Owen Doyle would certainly excite the fans because he's a brilliant player, he's brilliant for the league as well, and he's guaranteed goals, Reggie, which is a rare thing for a centre forward, but in our league, but you can actually say he is guaranteed goals, and he'll bring a lot to the league and a lot to the St. Pat's team.
There's a really good feeling, I feel, about this season coming. February, of course, when that'll be starting. But, you know, you've got Derry, who seem to have a lot of money behind them now. Pats are in a decent place. You know, Rovers, Shamrock Rovers, obviously going well. Dundalk and Drogheda trying to turn things around up there. Bowes competing really well in that final. So all of a sudden, there's like six or seven really good quality squads coming together to make what looks like could be a very interesting and exciting league this year.
Yeah, absolutely, Reggie. I'm so looking forward to it. I think it could. There was a feeling maybe just prior to the pandemic. I remember there was a game Dundalk played Shamrock Rovers up in Tallaght. There was 7,000 at it, and Dundalk were in their pomp as well. And Shamrock Rovers beat them 3-2. Jack Byrne got a great winning goal, but the Jordan Flores goal was in that match as well. And there was just a sense, it was just, I think it was February, March time, just before the pandemic kicked off, and there was just a sense that something big is about to happen in the league because there was huge interest in it. Then, of course, the pandemic kicked in and knocked everyone back. But I do feel, Reggie, we're on the verge of something that maybe the league is about to take off. Certainly, you look at the interest from the fans, you look at the ticket sales, season tickets, they're all up all over the place. You look at the players now that are being attracted in terms of, I know we've lost one or two across the water, which is always going to be the case with some younger lads looking for opportunities, and good luck to them. The likes of Jimmy Brown went to Blackburn this week. A couple of lads went to Scotland as well. and looks like maybe young Johnny Kenny could be going to Scotland. But you look at Jack Byrne coming back into the league, Owen Doyle, Duff, who we haven't even mentioned. I think Duff's going to be a massive addition because of the profile and the status that he carries as well, and the clout. So the interest is going to be on the league, Reggie, this year. I think it'll be as big as we've ever seen it, and I'm really, really looking forward to it.
Yeah, absolutely. So am I. Can't wait. And it won't be long now. Okay, across the water then, it's that time of year. There's transfer news going on and everything else. But I suppose the big news last week was the Villa capture of Coutinho. A big coup from, you know, getting someone like that from Barcelona for Villa. A quality signing for them.
Oh, it's absolutely massive news for them, Reggie. Who would have thought Villa would have been signing Coutinho on loan for Barcelona? But I think it just goes to show the Steven Gerrard factor, because obviously he played with him at Liverpool. He said that he's his friend. He's remained close to him. He's obviously been in touch. And that's the main reason that he's coming to Villa, purely for Steven Gerrard. If Gerrard wasn't at Villa, I don't think you would have seen Coutinho there at all. So it just goes to show again, talking about Duff and the clout that he will carry. You look at the clout that Steven Gerrard carries over there. And I've been really impressed with Gerrard since he's gone in. I feel like he obviously did a very good job at Rangers, but since he's gone in at Villa as well, I've been so impressed with him. More so with how he conducts himself and carries on. There's nothing about Steven Gerrard, the player. This is all about Steven Gerrard trying to carve out a top managerial career for himself, and how he behaves and conducts himself. And he's going about it certainly the right way at the moment. And I think the signing of Coutinho, 29 years of age, Reggie, I know things didn't work out for him at Barcelona, but him coming to Villa at 29, and Gerrard will certainly get a tune out of him. I think it's a massive signing for them.
And also, as you rightly say, the Stevie Gerrard factor, but also there will now be a Coutinho factor added to that. So other players now will be starting to look at Villa and saying that these are a team that are on the up, they're on the rise, and you know, there would be they'd be a decent team to join now, you know, because there might be league title chances in a couple of seasons' time, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a great point, because it is the reason he has signed is obviously Steven Gerrard. But as you say, if players are on the outside thinking of maybe going to Villa, you look at Coutinho playing there as well, that would certainly add to the excitement of maybe joining someone like them. So, I think they're in that category, Reggie. You look at the top three at the moment and they're miles ahead of everyone else. But you look at that kind of fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth. There's five or six teams there. And you look at, I suppose, Villa's best target should be West Ham. And you look what Moyes has done. A club of a similar stature, similar size, and maybe not has the budget of what the other clubs have. But you look at the job that he's done, Moyes, and he's kind of fighting in around that fourth and fifth position. I definitely think Gerrard is eyeing up something like that. Maybe like what Leicester have done as well. I know Arsenal have improved in recent weeks. You'll be delighted to see that, and Arteta is doing a decent job at the moment. So I do think there's a gap there for a team to emerge, the likes of a Villa, because I think it's wide open between four or five teams to maybe get that fourth place at the moment. So that's certainly a target I think Gerrard will have in the kind of near future, and as you say, who knows down the line. But I think the sign of Coutinho will only add to the quality that they have already, and he'd probably look to make more signings. But I do think Gerrard is going places, Reggie. I've been so impressed with him and how he's gone about his business, how he speaks. He did an interview a few weeks ago with Jamie Carragher, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic. So I definitely think Gerrard is going places in his managerial career.
Yeah, no doubt about it. It's definitely one to watch. The other huge managerial story, and it'll never be any different, I suppose, with a team like United, but is the Ralf Rangnick situation. And it's been a bad start, is the only way you can describe it. And it just doesn't feel like, that if you're a United fan, you wouldn't have a whole lot of confidence in what's going on at the minute.
No, it's a shambles from top to bottom, Reggie. It's really, really bad. And I think the focus has to turn to the players now, because for a long time I was critical of Solskjaer, and I felt obviously he was nowhere near up to the level or up to the job, and obviously he lost his job. Now Rangnick has come in with a good pedigree himself, but you look at the attitude of the players and they're all talking about being unhappy, and different reports coming out and murmurings coming out from different areas of the squad, and that's not good at all. I just think from top to bottom, the squad, the club itself is an absolute mess. You have Ed Woodward, who'll be moving on now himself in 6 to 8 months as well, so it's an absolute mess. Obviously, the Glazers are looking at it purely from a share price point of view, and I think they're quite happy once the money is coming in. But you look at what's going on the pitch, and it's an absolute shambles. They were well beaten again the other night by Wolves. And I made a statement during the week, Reggie, and I actually will stand over this, because I'm comparing it now, Man United, the situation or at the moment, to the likes of what Liverpool went through for 25 years, where they couldn't win a league, they couldn't win anything really. And I think this is what's ahead for Man United. I think it's going to be it's 5 years now since they've last won a trophy. It's coming up to 8 years since Ferguson left. And I think we're going to see another 15, 20 years of them being miles behind before we ever see them doing anything again. Because not only are they trying to overtake one team, it's three teams now they're trying to overtake. Because you look at how far Liverpool are ahead of them, how far Chelsea are ahead of them, and obviously Man City, how far they're ahead of everyone. So I think there's a massive job on their hands there. Ragnick was the wrong appointment, in my view, because you needed someone to come in and ruffle feathers and maybe give a lot of these lads a kick up the backside. The likes of Conte, you look at what he's done even at Spurs, kicked a few of them up the backside and given them a shake. And they've improved in recent weeks. I know they were poor enough in the cup game during the week, but they have improved. And he will certainly ruffle feathers. Ragnick, if he's walking into a job upstairs in 6 months, going into a director of football / consultancy role or whatever it is, the title is going to be, he's not going to ruffle feathers there in the next 6 months. So it was the wrong appointment, in my view. And I think we're seeing the results of that on the pitch, because it's an absolute mess. And I think the culture and the toxicity of the squad, I think that's been borne out now when you see all these reports that are filtering out from the club, because that can't be good.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. It's a mess of a situation. Absolutely, we could talk about it for a long time, but unfortunately, we don't have the time. Tell me your podcast. What have you got coming up?
Yeah, we'll be kicking it off again in line with the league starting in mid-February, Reggie. So we'll be kicking it all back off, and with a few of these high-profile signings, maybe we'll have. Well, we had Owen Doyle on, to be fair, and he's a great lad, Reggie.
Yeah.
You'll enjoy him. He'd be worth getting on the show yourself there, because he's a great character as well.
Yeah.
He's one of these lads that just enjoys life, plays football with a smile on his face, and it's great to see him back.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, I think we might take you up on that. We might have a chat with them and find out what life was really like over in the UK these days, and then the decision to come back here.
You can ask him then, Reggie, about his lucrative contract.
Yes,
yeah,
we'll get straight into it. How much are you getting? Spill the beans. Yeah, that would be a good exclusive to get, no doubt about it. Time to turn our attention to rugby, and I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Will Slattery of the Irish Independent and, of course, the Left Wing Podcast. Morning, Will. How are you?
Good, thanks, Reggie. How are you?
Very great, thanks. Yeah, happy new year and welcome back. It's good to be back. In a somewhat disjointed way, it has to be said, with rugby, it was a bit messy over the Christmas period, as was most sport with the COVID situation. But we're back tonight with a big game down in Thomond Park, Munster taking on Ulster. And Munster really needing a win desperately, having lost to Connacht, and with all of the furore that's going on down around there, they need a big performance tonight, don't they?
Massively. It's been a really interesting reaction to the Munster defeat, because, or the Connacht defeat against Connacht rather, because on the face of it, they've only lost two matches this season, one to the Ospreys and one to Connacht, and they're in a pretty good position in Europe. But the manner of defeat just seemed to kick off a whole host of questions, like even Keith Wood going on off the ball during the week, who you know, he was very plugged in down in Munster, very popular guy there, lives in the area, and he was very critical at all, but, you know, calling for $100,000 to basically depart mid-season because he's so annoyed with how they're playing. And I think they only threw 45 passes across the entire game, which is a startling statistic and a damning indictment about the work that's allegedly being done in terms of, you know, improving that attack. So it's a huge game for them today. And it's an interesting one. Jack Crowley is playing it out half. He hasn't got a huge amount of opportunities. So it's a massive game for him as well, because another poor performance now going into the European games, and the pressure will really ratchet up. It's a really interesting game for Munster because, as I said, on the face of it, their season, they're still in good position in both competitions, but there's a sense with the news of the departures of the coaches and that upheaval that things could unravel kind of quickly if they get a couple more bad results and a few bad performances. So it's really fascinating heading into tonight's game.
Yeah, I mean, that news of the coaches leaving, It's a funny one, because I kind of heard rumours about Johan van Graan a while ago, maybe even 12 months ago, if not longer, that there was a little bit of unrest, and not that the kind of the players themselves weren't all that happy with his methodology and everything else. And yet then it came out that he was still going to be there. And this one is the opposite. It felt like when things were all settled, now he's going. It's a very odd situation.
It is, and it's a funny one. Like personally, I don't think it's a bad thing that there's a change going to be made. Like I like, has Van Gran massively improved them from where they were? Has he got them closer to winning a trophy? I definitely think he brought in stability when Rossy Erasmus left mid-season. That's not an easy thing to do in rugby. I know in football it's pretty common, but in rugby less so. I think he did a good job the first year or two to steady the ship and get them into semi-finals. But the last two or three seasons, there hasn't been any progress, really. It's funny, like when I heard he was being offered a new two-year deal, I was actually pretty surprised initially. I thought, geez, I would have thought it was a good time to maybe to kick on and get someone else to bring it on. Like Keith Earls had a really interesting book, you know, brought out recently. And in it, he said he thinks one of the things holding Munster back has been the amount of upheaval they've had. I think they've had like five coaches since they last, you know, won a Heineken Cup, or maybe four since they last won a trophy. But I think, you know, stability or you know, staying with the same coach just for the sake of continuity, I don't think is a good thing either. So it's funny, initially I thought it was a good thing, but given how the season slightly unraveled then in the last couple of weeks since, it is a really interesting one. And I take your point, like it is funny how now the news has come true that there's a departure. Things do seem to have changed. We've seen this before when the Joe Schmidt news was announced. Ireland did seem to kind of go off the boil a little bit. It's an interesting dynamic with a squad when you know a coach is leaving at the end of the season. So, yeah, it's a really fascinating dynamic. And to see how it plays out over the next 3 weeks with some big games to play will be really interesting.
Well, it's a really difficult thing when you know a coach is leaving, because there's massive unease and unrest. I've been through a few situations like that myself, and players, whether they like it or don't like it, I mean, when there's a change of coach, players that are there in a situation like that, they're immediately, what'll go into your head is, right, well, who's the next guy going to be, and is he going to like me, and am I going to get on well with him? Where do I stand now? Where's my position? Am I going to get my game? All of these other doubts. I mean, no matter what they might say publicly, people will always go back to themselves in their own way, and they'll wonder, well, how does this affect me? What does this mean for me? And that's a big issue at this stage of a season.
Yeah, and it's funny, I think the queue for Graham Rowntree's office will be out the door, because he's the guy who's staying on for sure. I think the rest of the coaching staff is leaving, so if you want to kind of curry favour or make a good impression with one guy, Graham Rowntree's probably the guy to do it. And another interesting piece of it is, you know, looking ahead to next season, the recruitment. You know, there's rumours already that Orgie Snyman and Jason Jenkins, the two South African second rows, who haven't really played, I think, you know, barely played for Munster at all, could be following Johan van Gran.
Okay, we seem to have...
Or as well, if he's taking guys with them too. So it's very, very interesting dynamic.
Absolutely. Sorry, I just lost you for a second there. Okay, well, let's have a little move over to Leinster then. I mean, it's been a very disruptive season for them too, it has to be said, with the COVID situation and games being cancelled and defeats that are not of their own making being given against them with 28-0 Montpellier. And that Montpellier game now in jeopardy as well, I believe, because of COVID in their camp. So kind of a messed up season for Leinster that they need to get back on track fairly quickly as well.
Yeah, it's funny considering, as you say, they haven't really, like, you know, had a big defeat or anything like that. But at the same time, you know, we're in January now, and it's been a bit of a nightmare season for Leinster. Like, by the time they take the field next, you could potentially, when they play Bath away, could have only played 3 matches in 12 weeks, which is crazy considering after the November internationals, we were looking at a really, you know, pedal to the floor period for club rugby, where Leinster could have had, like, 10 big games and 10 consecutive weekends, obviously because of COVID, you know, in their own camp and then in other camps, that has been completely torn up. So from a Leinster perspective, you know, the Six Nations break is coming pretty shortly as well. There'll be rescheduled games during that period, a couple of big ones against Munster and a few other teams, but that will be without their key guys. So, you know, it could just be they play Bath and then they don't really reconvene as a Leinster squad with their full-strength team until a knockout European game, which is a pretty disastrous way for Leo Cullen and Stuart Lancaster to prepare for some big matches. There's not really much you can do, I suppose. Like, I think ideally they would have loved to have had a game this weekend, but the South African fixture had already been rescheduled before Leinster had even had COVID. So it's a real head-scratcher. Like, there's only so much behind-closed-doors training games you can do, even when your squad is as competitive as Leinster's is. One saving grace, you would say, is that since the Irish squad has so many Leinster guys in it, they will still be playing together and, you know, in a cohesive way, but albeit with different coaching staffs, different game plans. So it's a very tricky spot for the Leinster coaching staff, the Leinster squad. And it'll be really interesting, as you say, what happens with that Montpellier game. They really need to play a game, and they need it quickly, even from an Ireland perspective, because Andy Fyle won't want guys going in who, you know, I think 13 guys started against the All Blacks who have barely played a game since that match. Like, it's a really crazy situation.
Yeah, absolutely. I see, you know, with the regards to round three and four, there seems to be a little bit of stability in the championship with France have put in a term, something to do with economic activity. So because it's a professional sport going over to play, there'll be a form of exemption for the likes of Leinster and the English teams going to France, so those round three and four games can go ahead.
Yeah, it's really good news. It's just a shame that it didn't arrive, you know, before round two, because I don't really see what the difference really is between then and now. I know the French, similar to last season, they did a similar kind of thing just before rounds three and four, and they had to completely rejig it. But at least these rounds are going ahead. The one concern, I suppose, it's good that like these games are going ahead officially, but the COVID situation is still very fluid. I know La Rochelle, I think their game this weekend is postponed against Toulon. Toulon, kind of similar to Leinster, I don't think have played a game in quite a while. They're in the Challenge Cup, but still, it just kind of shows you that the you know, COVID is still quite rife. You know, one thing is that the English teams, there haven't been that many cancellations this year, so at least say a Leinster Bath fixture, you'd be pretty confident of going ahead. But yeah, some of the games with French sides, as we mentioned Montpellier, it would be a kind of a funny turn of events whereby Leinster give away a 28-0 and then get a 28-0 back, where in reality I think both teams would just love to play each other.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it would be a shame that that doesn't happen. The IRFU have been battered in the last couple of years financially because of COVID, huge losses across the board. They desperately need this Six Nations and the home games and the income that comes from that, but it's very much in doubt at the moment. What's the latest on the ground on that and the likelihood of the games moving to England?
Well, I think there's zero chance of Ireland's home games being played in England. I think the IRFU have already said that. I think they're operating that the games will go ahead in Ireland, and they're hoping that the games will go ahead with crowds. It remains to be seen. At the moment, if the game was played today against Wales, the opening fixture, there would only be 5,000 people in the Aviva Stadium, which would be a pretty poor sight considering last time we were there for an Ireland game, it was a full house.
That would be a loss-making exercise again, though. You know, they'd be better off.
Oh, 100%, yeah. Doors. Yeah, so the current regulations expire on January 31st. There is a hope out there that with the way the kind of the ICU hospital numbers are going, that potentially by the end of the month, we could be in a position where everyone acknowledges that this is maybe a milder kind of, you know, strain, and that potentially going back to, you know, full crowds or even 50% capacity or a meaningful crowd is a possibility. I would be in that camp. I wouldn't be surprised if we did have a decent crowd in the Aviva. It might be tough to see a full crowd going from 5,000, but I wouldn't be surprised if we did get 50%, because, you know, February 5th is a long way away. There's still 2 or 3 weeks to go. I think a lot can happen between then and now. I don't think anyone can really predict with any certainty what numbers will be in the Aviva for that first game, but I would be cautiously optimistic that we could have a decent, meaningful crowd, and that it'll keep maybe the finances ticking over. And then later on in the tournament when they play there, I think Italy is the midway point of the Six Nations. You'd hope by then, you know, almost 2 months later, we could be looking at full capacity. Because when it happened in November, there was still a lot of COVID cases. I think there was no outbreaks in those games. I think everything went off very swimmingly, and the protocols in the stadium were very well run. So I'd be confident that we can get back to that, hopefully sooner rather than later.
Yeah, you'd imagine logic would tell you that they aren't likely to go to full capacity in such a short turnaround from, say, the end of January to the following week. But perhaps 50% capacity at a staggered increase might be the logical thing to do, you know?
Yeah, like it's a really interesting kind of visage across the Six Nations. Obviously, you have England, who are full capacity. France, who I think are 5,000 as well, similar to Ireland. Wales are nobody. And I think Scotland is 500 people. So it's really up in the air in terms of what crowds will be. I know they're having a similar debate in Wales. They just go over, you know, the bridge and go over to the UK for their opening game against Scotland, because I think their second two home games might be in March. So, you know, they have a little bit of wiggle room in terms of waiting a period. So it's not just an Irish conversation. It'll be really interesting to see, you know, what the other countries do. I think Italy are also at full capacity. Mm. So they have that too. But yeah, again, it's funny that we're back here again, you know, third year in a row. after November, it was such a high to have that All Blacks game rocking once again. And then here we are debating 5,000, 10,000. God, it feels like, you know, Groundhog Day again, doesn't it?
Sure does. GAA with Declan Drake on Dublin's Talking Sport.
Declan Drake with you here, guiding you through the very best of Gaelic games in the capital over the next few minutes. And indeed, on the first weekend of 2022, the games in the city spring into life with two of our county flagship teams engaged in pre-season fare and three club sides between men's and ladies football doing battle for provincial glory and advancement in the ladies' case in their respective All-Ireland championships. We start with football and Dublin's trip to Tullamore to face Offaly in the Auburn Cup. This will be the Blues' first outing since their All-Ireland semi-final loss to Mayo last August. Indeed, as is always the case, this competition, back on the calendar following last year's cancellation due to COVID, affords boss Desi Farrell, now in year three in charge, an opportunity to rule the roost over the finest young talent available to him as he attempts to rebuild the county's fortunes. Offaly, for their part, enjoyed a fine All-Ireland Under-20 success last year, beating Dublin en route in the provincial final. And no doubt, several of those players will cross paths at the Midlands venue tomorrow afternoon. Former Dublin skipper Coleman Goggins, speaking to me recently, offered his assessment of where Dublin football is at this moment in time.
Tyrone were able to seize on something, grab a hold of it and get over the line. So it does put Dublin back into the pack, because Tyrone won the All-Ireland, Mayo bet Dublin. So invariably you fall as number three in the pecking order as it sits looking at All-Ireland, we'll say, you know. We'd carry then, well, we maybe are joint third, if not ahead of you in that instance, you know. So Dublin certainly come back into the pack. So is it pressure on or pressure off? I'd say it's a fresh start in some respects. So is it the end of an era? We won't know that till next summer and we see where Dublin land. Certainly was the end of a run that I never thought I'd see in my lifetime, particularly during my time playing, trying to get to an All-Ireland final was a challenge. Yeah. So to win, you know, six of them on the spin and eight in, you know, a 10, 11 year period or whatever is a phenomenal achievement by the group and by the players who've come and gone and are still there at the moment. So I think there's huge potential for the team to start again and start afresh. There's probably a need to uncover new talent, or at the very least see if some of the talent that's out there that's not currently involved could come back into the fold. You know, you specifically think of Paul Mannion, and then, as I mentioned, maybe there's one or two fellas who've been there before that might be interested in coming back into this setup. If they are, great, gives Dublin a lift, and if not, then, well, you've got to make do with what you have and hope that 2022, COVID aside, allows people to express themselves on a football field and Dublin to challenge again.
Indeed, we wish Desi and the crew every success in Tullamore there tomorrow afternoon. We switch our attention now to hurling, and tomorrow marks a return to the coalface for the county's hurlers. Matty Kenny's Blues have home advantage at Parnell Park from 2 p.m. when they open their Walsh Cup campaign against Antrim, a team indeed they beat twice last year, once in the league and in the championship. At the end of that championship campaign, which did record victories in the province of Leinster over Antrim and Galway before eventually losing to beaten finalist Cork at the quarter-final stage, Galway native Kenny had his term in charge of the team extended. 2022 will be his fourth year in charge in all. And no doubt, he's well boosted by the quality of some of the under-20s coming through over the last couple of years. Former Dublin minor and under-21 boss Sean Lane, our hurling analyst here on Dublin's Talking Sport, firmly believes that Kenny is in a strong place with the panel at his disposal.
But I did meet Jimmy Barry Murphy, and he gave me the greatest advice. He said, your job, he said, is to get the best players in the county to play for you and get the very best out of the best players on the field. Now, I'll be ready to go. The National League, as far as I know, Declan, is probably the end of January, so it's a very, very quick start. So get the right squad, get the right players, sit them down, tell them what you want to do, and have your task plan, as we used to call it. Say, we have to play these matches, we have to do these training sessions, we have to go to the gym, you know, and keep talking to them and keep listening to them. There'll be concerns, but you know, I think Matty's in a good place, because Matty probably knows 90% of what his panel's going to be, because he's on where, you know, other managers other than Brian Cody will be trying to find their feet. So I think he's a long way down the road. Last year was an improvement on the previous year. If we get another improvement, you know, God knows where we'll end up.
To the club scene now. It's a big day this afternoon for Kilmacud Crokes as they hunt down a fifth Leinster Senior Club Football Championship title. Robbie Benson's Purple and Gold Chargers face Kildare Kingpins Naas at Croke Park from 5 o'clock. The Dublin champions have already seen off the Kingpins of Meath and Laois pre-Christmas to reach this decider, and they certainly know they're going to be in some battle in their bid to bring the title back to the Southside. We here at Dublin's Talking Sport wish them every success in their endeavours this evening. Finally this week to the Ladies Club Championship, where our two remaining county champions are in action in the quarter-final stages of the current account.ie championships. Intermediate Queen St Sylvester's have home advantage against London's Holloway Gales this afternoon. That's at 1:30 out in Malahide. While tomorrow, Junior Queens St Jude's travel to St Margaret's to face again English opposition, this time in the shape of Tiernanogue from Newcastle. And that one will get underway at 12 o'clock. And for fans unable to make either game, both will be shown on the LGFA Facebook page.
NFL time now. Delighted to be joined on the line by Stephen O'Brien. Good morning, Steve. How are you?
Good morning, Reg. What's going on? Bright and early. How
Absolutely.
Are you?
Absolutely. Bright and early, and a happy new year to you. And hopefully it will be a great new year. It's coming to the business end of things for the NFL. A lot of teams have their last game. And what games are still kind of going to create implications for playoffs? Or is there any hurdles that some teams have to get over?
No, always. This is the last game of the season, as you say, the regular season, because I know for the last couple of weeks, Reg, we've said, this is the business end, and now this is the business end. I mean, this is where, you know, you play your last game. If you don't win, well, then you're like me and you. They're at home, sitting on the couch, even though they're professional, you know, players, and they're sitting there watching the playoffs with us. But there's two things to really look at here. There's the NFC and the AFC, and the leader of both going to the Super Bowl, that's what it was. So the NFC is pretty much locked up, so there's not a whole lot going on. The Packers have the number one seed, Wahey, which is my team. But the only game to look out for there, I know, like a humble brag.
You did predict, but the only one to look, I'll say that at the beginning start of the season. Way back when we all were looking at who might take it, you did predict it, so we'll give you that.
Yeah, although it comes off really biased. You know, it's like
no, it's not.
Man United.
No, no bias. It was a good, it was a level-headed prediction.
It was. Well, I tried to act cool. So there's the Niners and Saints, Red in the NFC. So basically with this, whoever wins is in. So the Niners play the Rams and the Saints play Atlanta Falcons. Now, if you look at that, you go, oh, well, the Saints are in, right? But then you look at the Niners who played the Rams and they haven't won there for, you know, five straight games. So that doesn't look too good. Now, in the AFC, which is the other side, there's 130 different permutations. And we're going to go through every single one this morning. Now, look, there's you could go through. The problem with it is that some teams can get in and then some teams are already in, but they can jump up and down through the seeding. And we all know what that means from rugby and World Cups and all that. The higher seeds are the worst team, like in quotes, you play in the playoffs. But the ones really to look out for here, Reg, is that there's win and in games. So if the Colts win, they're in. Chargers win against the Raiders, they're in. The Raiders against the Chargers, they're in. So that game there, whoever wins gets in. And there's really sort of outlandish stuff with the Steelers and the Ravens, but they both depend on a Colts loss. So the minute you see that Colts loss come in, they're out. And then the only thing that really has to be decided then in the AFC is that coveted number one seed. Now, why does anyone care? Well, if you get the number one seed like the Packers have, you have a bye week in the first round of the playoffs. You get the rest up, you don't play. And then all of your games, as long as you keep winning, because if you lose, you're out. If you keep winning, you play those games at home. So you have that home field advantage as well. So AFC, messy. NFC, not that messy. But either way, the Packers have the bye. And the New England Patriots, who we've talked about all season, they can clinch the number one seed in the NFC, but it's almost impossible at this stage. But yeah, all still to play for. Final game. Great. Yeah,
absolutely. There was some bizarre behaviour going on as well with Antonio Brown. He quit mid-game. What was that all about?
Yeah, you know, it's bad when you see your player, wide receiver, take off his you know, his gear and go topless off the field at halftime. Do you know what? We've seen this outlandish behaviour from Antonio Brown, and we've spoke about him every single year. And there's about one or two stories every year of will he play, won't he play, and when he does play, he falls out with his team. But the outstanding sort of coverage of all of this was, and to give people a really quick background of this actual story was, is that he's playing for the Bucs, they're in the middle of the game against the Jets. They're actually losing. So they need Antonio Brown. He's a superstar wide receiver, been quite troubled over the last a couple of, you know, years. And then all of a sudden, mid-game, and this has never been seen before by any of the pundits or anybody watching the game, you see him take off his pads, he's topless, he throws his stuff on the sideline, and then he starts, he throws his gear into the crowd, and then he goes off the field through the end zone, jumping up and down, sort of, you know, getting the crowd all rowdy, and then leaves mid-game. And then he's seen after that, sort of, you know, they say calling for an Uber, but apparently he had a car. And then he's cussed by the Bucks then after. And there's just massive fallout, Reg, between what exactly happened. The story goes, he had an ankle injury. He said to Bruce Arians, the head coach, I've got an ankle injury, I can't play anymore. And he told him, you know, get out there onto the field. And he said, no. And then he says, right, get out of here, you're done. And then he went and quit, you know, on the team. So AB saying, I was told to leave. Bruce Arians was saying, you know, this ankle injury wasn't a thing. He was fit to play. He should have played. He refused to play because he wasn't getting the ball. And, you know, there's more player that I won't get into. Like, Antonio Brown has loads of these incentives based on how many catches he makes, how many touchdowns he scores. And there's all of this swirling about, you know, had they let him play and had they targeted him more, he would have got about $1 million in incentives. It's very messy. But look, anything that comes out of this, and usually you see people sort of take the pee at someone that does something like this and go, oh, he's being crazy again, you know, this is him, he's sort of a diva player. But for Antonio Brown, there's massive concerns over his mental health because he's taken some massive hits. And there's a very distinct difference in him between when he got a massive head injury by a guy called Vontaze Burfict. And people are trying to compare how his behavior before that and after that. And they're pointing towards CTE and saying that, you know, he's troubling, he's got issues. And so that's why you'll find no one really who's sort of, you know, read up on this type of thing is really taking this lightly. They kind of look at it. And even Tom Brady, his quarterback, who vouched for him and got him there. He got him there with the Patriots. He got him there with the Bucks. You know, he came out immediately. And you'd expect someone, if someone quits on your team, to go, oh, he's a terrible teammate and this, that, and the other. Yeah. He's gone now. But he turned around and said, look, you know, I hope he gets the help he deserves. And there's other stories are coming out that he's quite erratic. He went on a podcast, actually. I think it was last night. And if you just watch that podcast, it's not, just some of the stuff isn't very coherent, Reg. So there's definitely something else to play there. On. So, and I hope he does get the help he needs.
Hopefully. Okay, don't have a whole lot of time left, but I want to kind of get into the Super Bowl favourites with the bookies. I know, obviously, your heart is going to be going Packers all the way, but who at this stage are likely to be in the final, and who do you think is going to ultimately take the Lombardi Trophy?
Yeah, so if you look at both sides, right, if you look at the NFC and the AFC real quick, but the bookies' favourites, the Packers are the favourites, which is great because if you've got the odds on when I was talking about them ages ago, you know, you've got great odds on them. Kansas City Chiefs seem to be back in full swing, Reg. They struggled kind of early in the season, but the offense looks back and the defense is holding up. So they look like to make it in again. The Buffalo Bills, again, are hot favourites. They're third. So again, you know, they were kind of... But all of these teams are a little bit shaky, and that's the thing, is that the Bills were the same, and then they went and had that sort of blowout win recently, which sort of people said, oh, right, they're back. The Los Angeles Rams as well, they're right up there, and the Tampa Bay Bucks. Outside of that, it kind of drops off quite heavily. You know, we've got Cowboys and Titans and Patriots and Bengals and Cardinals and all these teams. But the main ones to look for are Packers, Chiefs, Bills, Rams and Bucks. And they're really the cream of the crop. And anybody who beats them, you know, into the playoffs is a real upset because they shouldn't. But there's other teams that are hot at the minute, like the Bengals. You know, people are looking at Joe Burrow. They had plus 8,000 and they're down to plus 1,800 now. So it just goes to show, like, they're one of the biggest drops ever because they're really dominant. It all depends, Reg. If you get a hot streak, you know, coming into the playoffs, which is exactly why the Packers had a meaningless game this week, but they're still going to play their starters because they want to kind of hold on to that hot streak at the rim. That's what it'll come down to. But the cream of the crop at the minute looks to be Packers v. Chiefs. And I'm hoping it happens and I hope we wax them in the Super Bowl. But look, anything can happen in the playoffs. It's winning out.
It's a nice position for you to be in. There's no doubt about it.
Not so bad.
Hopefully that will be the case. Okay, as always, Stephen, Happy New Year to you and welcome back to the show. Looking forward to having many more chats as we get down to the business end of the season now with the Super Bowl just around the corner. Okay, you take care of yourself. We'll chat again next week.
Cheers, Red.
Thanks for listening to Dublin Stock and Sport on Sunshine 106.8 from myself, Ken and Reggie. Have a good weekend.